Hello everyone, and welcome to our podcast, A Global Perspective on European Politics. Today, our topic is the energy relationship between European Union and the Central Asian states. Today, our guest is Dr. Morena Scalamera. She is an assistant professor of Russian and International Studies at Leiden University. She teaches courses in international political economy with regional focus on Russia and Eurasia. Her research interests include the political economy of Eurasia, Russia and post-Soviet politics, and the geopolitics of energy in Eurasia. She is currently working on a book manuscript that examines how energy firms have shaped the energy relationship between Russia and Europe and the energy strategies of the former Soviet states. Morena, thank you so much for joining us today and welcome. I would like to start with the, as you know, probably you have been already listening, reading and attending events. Currently the conflict, the war between Ukraine and Russia. And this conflict has a lot of implications on human dimension, infrastructures, and one of the most important dimension is the energy security. As you know, Russia and Ukraine are the important players in the European energy sphere. I'm wondering, what are your reflections with regard to European energy security and implications of this current war?
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here. Fascinating topic in light of current events, indeed. Yeah, the European Union announced last week that it would cut its reliance on Russian natural gas by two-thirds by the end of this year and get off Russian fossil fuels entirely by the end of this decade. And so it's an ambitious plan, and the plan laid out several steps on how it would cut its dependence on Russia's natural gas, including working with international partners to diversify its natural gas supply. Then there's other elements of this plan, such as speeding up permitting for renewable energy projects and adding solar panels and energy efficiency improvements to homes and buildings. But what's crucial here for Central Asia is this working with international partners to diversify its natural gas supply. So those international partners could include, besides Norway, which is always a key partner, outside of the EU, it could include Caspian states such as Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan. Getting more piped natural gas from places like Central Asia is theoretically possible, but does not happen overnight for reasons that I will expand more later, and needs to be coordinated. In other words, to take advantage of these possibilities, a more dynamic EU governance is needed. And there are positive signs that this is already emerging. But most of all, the war in Ukraine has galvanized support for accelerating the EU's so-called Green Deal. So renewable energy and energy efficiency will be the priority and will be the number one answer to the crisis here. And a word of caution here in terms of, you know, reducing both gas demand and dependency on imports and boosting energy efficiency is that all this could have impacts for energy poverty. So ensuring that especially those of lower incomes are protected from rising energy prices will be a challenge. Because as you know, fuel prices were already elevated before the war in Ukraine.
Exactly.
Prompting calls across Europe for government relief. And so there is a little interest right now in Europe for further instability in energy markets. And it's not yet clear within the European complicated and complex multi-level governance who will rally the European public, especially since some national governments have a limited appetite for tough measures at home, given the high energy prices right now. But returning to boosting imports from non-Russia suppliers, like I said, all EU states have different import dependency pictures, so dissimilar priorities. You know that the EU is a strange animal, and national governments are the ones that decide the particular and peculiar supply picture of their own country. So there's no single EU country that has the exactly same import dependency on Russia or the exactly same energy mix as another country. So you have to add this to the already very high gas prices in Europe. Long story short, in the short term, you could see a temporary comeback of coal in the EU, and we already seen some signs of that. Today in the newspaper, I read that countries like Czech, Bulgaria, Italy, that traditionally rely highly on gas for electricity generation, are thinking about reintroducing coal temporarily. Then nuclear energy could see a renaissance in Europe. Another thing that you will see is the US emerging as a key LNG supplier to Europe. And then more attention will be given to East Med countries, North Africa, along with Norway and potentially Central Asia. And I will expand on this later. But I'd like to say a few things on Russia and its own response.
Mm-hmm.
You have a situation where Moscow has gone so deep into the hole that it has not much to lose, given the extraordinary intensity already of the sanction regime. So there is a possibility, a distinct possibility of countermeasures by Moscow, in my view, given how far they've gone, and I don't see them de-escalating the crisis right now. So we, as Europeans, should be prepared for potential retaliation in response to the sanction regime. I'm not saying that that would happen, but it is a possibility.
So you think Russia came so far, or this crisis moved so far, even Russia wouldn't consider to involve the energy security within this conflict as well? Because so far it is kind of indirectly mentioned, but you think that Russia wouldn't mind even to, let's say, danger it is energy relations as well with Europeans?
I think Russia would mind, and I think it would be disastrous. And I think Russia has taken great pains always in the last 40, 50 years to remind Europeans that they have been a reliable supplier, that they have never failed to supply the EU. And mm-hmm. those interruptions in 2006 and 2009 were Ukraine's fault, and that Russia has always delivered gas promptly to the Europeans, and it has been a mutual relationship that has been fruitful for both countries, both blocs, over the decades. Even in the moments of high ideological divide during the Cold War, those relations have been fruitful. So that has been the rhetoric of the Russians over the decades. But what you see now is, paradoxically, the Russian government has a lot less to lose by continuing down this path, because what we've done so far with Russia, with these extraordinary sanctions, it's been all stick and no carrot. Not carrot, meaning we haven't negotiated with Russia in a way where we have offered something. It's been all punishment, punishment, punishment. So, paradoxically, I could see Russia going down this path, potentially, given that sanctions are really tough. There's no path for diplomacy yet. So it's a game-changing moment. So even though, as you say, in the past, Russia has been very careful to present itself as a reliable supplier, this is now a game-changing moment. And paradoxically, maybe we could see a different dynamics. Because, as I said, from our side, from the European side and the US side, so far, it's been mostly sticks and no carrots. I just wanted to say, in terms of like implications for broader energy security, I would say two main takeaways are: this transition will cause disruptions, and we're likely to see greater emphasis on energy reduction and efficiency measures, and we're seeing that in the EU already. We should expect a sustained, number two, we should expect a sustained high energy price environment for the foreseeable future. In an environment of high geopolitical risk and tight oil and natural gas markets, prices are likely to continue to be high. Now, one thing that is important to mention is that at the moment, there is no material supply shock that is boosting those prices. So it's not that there are shortages, and that's why we're seeing spikes in gas prices. But it's rather this uncertainty. In other words, higher prices are caused by fears of a supply shock connected to these geopolitical events, rather than an already existing supply mm-hmm. shock.
Yeah.
So that's an important clarification here, I think. And then in terms of, you know, energy security theory and paradigm shifts, and that's the last point I want to make in this question, is that Russia's recent weaponization of Europe's energy dependency, like Europe saying that we simply cannot rely on a supplier who explicitly threatens us. So this weaponization, again, on potential weaponization of energy dependency, might problematize one of the cardinal, you know, principle principles of liberal economic theory, namely that economic interdependence fosters peace. This has been one of the central tenets on which we have built this relationship over the decades, this gas interdependence with Russia. Russia depends on us, we depend on Russia, therefore both sides gain, and it's too costly to break it, and it also fosters peace. It could be that this crisis leads to radical rethink and reappraisal of these benefits of trade dependency and interdependence in strategic goods such as oil, gas. For Europe, this might mean more securitization policies and a paradigm shift once again to fortress Europe mode, if you wish. But even though energy security is a priority for policymakers in Europe and the United States, will require new prioritization and a rethink, I don't see a world where energy security means a scramble for oil and gas in a grand chessboard type of battle, like you used to see or think about it in the past. I don't see that kind of world returning. I think that's a bygone era. Yep. Renewables will increasingly be part of the answer for us in Europe, even as we securitize once again.
Indeed. And very good points that you mentioned here. Unfortunately, when we look at this geopolitical aspect of this energy, and right now what we feel is the local population in Europe, they feel the energy price in their budgets, even though there is no shortage. So the human dimension is here, is a very good aspect that you highlighted, that currently European market, European governments and people living in Europe, they feel this in their monthly prices as well. I think Tom has some questions regarding your answer. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, no, I was just wondering. We know, right, that Europe has implemented sanctions. And you talked about Russia possibly implementing retaliatory sanctions in return, right? But what would they look like? What could we expect in Europe? Can they just close the gas tap, or what can we expect?
Well, that's what I had in mind when I said that they could potentially retaliate. I'm not saying that they would, you know, there would be a comprehensive sanction regime, but just de facto import reductions of energy could be a possibility, given that so far we have waged this sanction war, which has been extraordinarily intense from our side, and the Russians are forced to turn increasingly towards China. It doesn't seem, I don't see them, you know, backing off. Putin is intent on doubling down so far, what I expect. So we will see a worsening of this crisis, in my view, in the next weeks, months. So that puts Russia in a very, very unfavorable position. And I don't see a path to diplomacy if we're only waging extraordinarily intense sanctions. So paradoxically, given that we brought in this human factor here, how is that acting on the psychology of Russians? It might make them think that they have nothing to lose. And so, you know, if we don't create a pathway for diplomacy. So what I'm trying to say here is that diplomacy would be useful, that sanctions are maybe not the only instrument we should be using here, this tough sanctions, and that it could dangerously escalate even more for us too.
So also sanctions are, I would say, two-sided knife, right? It cuts both sides to some extent, not only Russia, but also the European economy as well, and Western economy
and
as well.
We're aware of that.
Yeah.
Given how dangerously extreme this has gotten in the last couple of weeks, very quickly, it could foster retaliation. Although, like I said, historically, Russia has been at pains to remind us that it has always been a reliable supplier, but this is really, truly a game-changing development. Now, in terms of the European side, every crisis, it is also an opportunity for change. You know, history has shown us that the most consequential reforms of the past 50 years have been born out of conflict and high prices, such as the OPEC oil embargo, where European economies introduced high fuel taxes that fundamentally reshaped their economies to make them vastly less vulnerable to oil shocks in that case. Yep. So the current crisis can be a reminder that there are countless reasons to you know, aggressively decarbonize and that fossil fuels come along with many external risks. And yep. You can see that rhetoric kind of emerging already. If I can quote Frans Timmermans, lately he's been quoted saying, creating your own energy resources is the smartest and most urgent choice to ensure security of supply. So there will be an emphasis on this homegrown security of supply through decarbonization. And yes. You will see more and more of this kind of rhetoric going forward, I think.
Yes. And in terms of decarbonization and the current energy crisis, like the final point on this question, I also think that, and you also mentioned in your answer, it's not only fostering energy transition, but it's also fostering even the coal, nuclear energy, unfortunately, sources as well. And we also, I think you have also seen that this division between European vocabulary, what is green energy, and whether we count nuclear or natural gas also part of green energy. So still within Europe, this division with regard to energy sources, energy vocabulary is also one side, like one of the problems actually makes the current crisis maybe less workable. Or on the one hand, we see positive developments. On the other hand, we see even sometimes blames on renewable energy that, hey, look, if it was good, we wouldn't have current insecurity or something. So indeed, we observe here very interesting and strange developments when it comes to European energy security. And follow up, I think Tom has another question moving towards the Central Asian energy states. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, I know that we all know that the effects for Europe and Russia are pretty obvious, right? We are mostly affected by this. But what would you say are the implications of the conflict on Central Asian energy states?
Right, I'm getting to that. Just to circle back quickly on this energy, the European energy taxonomy. Yes, as you rightly point out, Europe is, the EU is multi-level governance system where already before the Ukraine crisis there have been controversies such as whether natural gas should be included as a clean energy source in this transition as a bridge fuel to a clean energy future and, some greener observers in Europe were outraged recently before this escalation of the war in Ukraine that oil and gas has been included as a clean source and nuclear too in the EU taxonomy latest proposals for this document that has been considered. So nuclear also was included as a bridge source along with renewables so on. Not to mention that now coal could see a temporary comeback because of the crisis. So there was already a great deal of confusion what sources should be treated as useful for a bridge to a renewable future, to a cleaner future, a greener future, and which sources should be outright banned in this overall taxonomy. And now, on top of that, you see high energy prices in Europe. So consumers might not be willing to make huge sacrifices at the moment and a high geopolitical uncertainty. And you also see divisions because of now the situation vis-a-vis Russia. Different countries have different import dependencies and so different immediate exigencies and priorities on how to tackle the crisis itself. So yes, it is a situation that will demand a high degree of coordination and leadership within the EU, and yeah, bears watching what will happen in the next days and months.
Mm-hmm. So if we then move on to the implications of the conflict to Central Asian states, right? What can you say on that?
Yes. So in terms of the Central Asian states, just to give a little bit of a historical background, even before the Ukraine crisis, there's been a long, albeit unfortunately, rather unsuccessful story about how Central Asian countries can help the EU diversify away from Russia. So depending on where you stand on this question, some countries were seeing this as the Central Asian countries helping wean the EU away from Russia. That's usually the American perspective, where Russia is seen as a problem, obviously. And some other countries that have a more, let's say, pragmatic, moderate stance of that, on that we're considering Central Asian supplies simply a welcome diversification. Mm-hmm. Already in 2011, in the EU, all member states gave a mandate to the EU Commission to negotiate with Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan. So since the end of 2011, the European Commission has been in negotiation with these two countries. So now for more than 10 years to get this gas from Central Asia to Europe. And if you see it in the perspective of more than 10 years, this has been quite unsuccessful because there has been little progress on that. So what's on the table? There is this so-called Trans-Caspian gas pipeline, a proposed subsea pipeline between Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan, which would then connect on, and it's a 30 billion cubic meters pipeline with an estimated cost of $5 billion. And that pipeline would then connect on existing pipelines from Azerbaijan and bring Central Asian gas essentially all the way to Europe. Those existing pipelines are the so-called Trans-Caucasus pipeline, South Caucasus pipeline, sorry, and then the Tanap pipeline. The South Caucasus pipeline is a pipeline that has existed since the 90s, and the Tanap pipeline has been inaugurated just a year ago or so. So this has been rather unsuccessful like I said, more than 10 years. But before the Ukraine crisis, external conditions for the construction of this Trans-Caspian gas pipeline, which is the most controversial one across the Caspian Sea, have become more favorable in the last couple of years. There's been two developments that have contributed to this. One is the signing of the Convention on the Legal Status of the Caspian Sea by five Caspian states in August 2018, and that was really important. So that was one milestone, making these gas pipelines a little bit more likely. And then another obstacle that was covered was in January 2021, when Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan signed a landmark agreement to jointly develop a long-disputed Caspian offshore gas field, the so-called Dostluk field.
Yeah, friendship.
This move could, in principle, pave the way for the transit of Turkmenistan's massive gas reserves to Europe. Then, you know, in early 2022, just recently, and then also before the Ukraine crisis, they made friendly signals, both Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan and Turkey. They met, and there were high-level statements supporting cooperation in facilitating transportations of gas from Central Asia to Europe. They signed memorandums of understanding, and so on and so forth. So they expressed their readiness to implement these joint projects for the delivery of energy resources all the way to Turkey and then onward to Europe. This was all happening before the Ukraine crisis. Now, the Ukraine crisis could add further urgency to this and boost these efforts to get these deliveries of gas from all the way from Central Asia, Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan is already delivering gas to Europe, but to boost some of these Azeri reserves too into Europe. Now, what is important to mention here is that both TANAP and TAP, so the existing leg of the so-called Southern Gas Corridor, both of these pipelines are already designed as scalable incremental pipelines. So in principle, both of them can swiftly be increased in capacity to supply gas from new fields, such as the one that was mentioned, the Dostluk field that they were disputing about and which has been solved recently. So there are some positive signs this could happen, but I would like to mention, again, a word of caution here is that there are limits to how quickly both the EU and countries in Central Asia can reorientate their export and import strategies and infrastructure in the short run. And so we shouldn't get too enthusiastic about this happening overnight. Why? Because of structural reasons, most long-distance gas pipelines are developed by the producers of gas or by producers in cooperation with consumers. They are rigid, long-horizon projects, and an important feature of these pipelines is that they tie countries in very intimate ways, changing patterns of consumption and dependence. So, and there's the existence of very tight contractual guarantees, which limits opportunistic behavior between producers and buyers. That's another very important feature of pipeline gas trade. And I can expand on this if you wish. But long story short, it would take time to create a consortium of companies committed to the project on both ends of the pipeline, investors willing to put their money on it, and to build the actual pipeline. So this isn't as easy as boosting European LNG supplies in a situation where you know, in Europe, receiving terminals are already there. LNG shipments are very flexible. LNG sellers are attracted by high prices, and more LNG ships can be simply rerouted to the European market as long as prices are attractive.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how gas pipelines happen. So, yes, there are more favorable conditions as of recent, but no, it would take time. So that would be my answer to this question.
Exactly. Because when what you mentioned about the Caspian Sea and the role of Azerbaijan and then the relationship between the Turkmenistan as well, because this Dostluk field, which is which means a friendship, and it is estimated that it has 50 million tons of oil in that field. So I think it's also part of this one of the, yeah, let's say, developments right now going on in the energy market, this energy transition. Because if you also don't explore this existing oil, in the future you don't know what will happen in the energy market. Demand can decrease and stuff. But overall, we should also here, I think, consider Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline as well, which Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, even Russia transport their oil through this pipeline to Ceyhan and then to the world oil market. And some of them, or most of them, comes to the European market as well in terms of oil. And in terms of energy, I think here you highlighted very good points, the relationship between the Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan and the signing of this legal convention. And last time it was only Iran who hasn't ratified the legal agreement yet. Four countries have already ratified this. And only one problem I think left here is, or another problem, maybe Turkmenistan's energy strategies, this buying from the door energy strategy, right? That's also one of the complications when it comes to the Trans-Caspian pipeline as well.
Absolutely. Turkmenistan at the moment doesn't have enough gas to quickly reorient its export strategy towards Europe, and it's fully committed to China. And that's one of the impediments that was there already before. So I just wanted to highlight in this question, like, the new conditions that are basically on the table given the Ukraine crisis. And one thing that I wanted to highlight now that you mentioned, and I think you're completely right, is in light of the development of this big gas and oil fields, ever since the energy transition has increased in pace and development the last couple of years, in a period of energy abundance, because oil and gas prices were low, the world has been under investing in these big gas and oil fields because energy companies are under pressure to divest from gas and oil fields due to the energy transition. Prices were low, so there was no appetite to go for this kind of big oil and gas fields. So some energy observers were basically arguing and warning that the world was at risk of tight markets and price spikes due to this underinvestment in the energy supply in this kind of big fields such as the Dostluk. And I think you mentioned that. And so now one of the questions, it will be also, you can't really reorient this pattern of underinvestment overnight. It takes time to kind of start again investing in those kind of fields and then building the pipelines, finding investors, and all that kind of thing. It's long horizon development. But faced with uncertainty about the outlook of oil and gas use because of climate policies, poor past financial performance, and pressure to divest from fossil fuels, energy firms' investments in the last couple of years have been low. And you can argue that that is partly what created these tight markets and price spikes today.
Exactly. So since we are talking also about the energy transition, and since we moved there, I also would like to ask this final question related to your one of the recent articles, which I really enjoyed to read. Because in your article, which also published at International Affairs Journal, and later on you had another version of the 2020 oil price dive in a carbon-constrained era, the strategies for the energy exporters in Central Asia. You mentioned that the global energy transition influenced the foreign policy of the petrostates in Central Asia. Back then, fossil fuel prices were not high, which you mentioned in your article as well, how this low fossil fuels impacted. But due to the current Ukraine-Russia conflict, energy price is quite high. Actually, is the highest moment right now, one of the highest moments right now. So I'm wondering what implications high energy prices and global energy transition might have on Central Asian energy policy.
That's a very good question. Thank you. Well, in a nutshell, the argument there was that as oil and gas demand in traditional destination markets, such as the EU, essentially, is not expected to grow, Eurasian petrostates, Central Asian petrostates, will sought to delay the outcomes of the energy transition on their economies by making important foreign policy adjustments. So by essentially looking for other hydrocarbon markets. The argument was that despite misgivings over dependency on China, Central Asian petrostates would probably be forced to increasingly turn eastward. Well, in terms of, you know, secular trends, that theoretical assessment is still there, is still valid. There is now a potential short-term reversal of that trend. The assessment was based on major premises. One, that the EU will continue to enjoy competitive Russian gas in the years to come as a bridge to a cleaner future and to complement its renewable energy policies. Two, that therefore Central Asian gas would simply not be able to outcompete cheap Russian gas on the EU market. And three, that the EU, given increasing optionality in LNG supplies, the availability of Russian gas and its renewable policies, in other words, relative abundance and cheap prices, simply did not have enough gas demand to accommodate an expensive pipeline all the way from Central Asia. Under these relatively cheap prices, there was no incentive to develop some of the expensive fields and pay for the high transit cost involved for an undersea pipeline that we discussed for gas delivery from Central Asia to Europe. Now, seen from the perspective of the pipeline developers, there was the problem of security of demand and the overall commercial rationale of building a new undersea pipeline and expanding existing pipelines, TAP and TANAP, and the new undersea pipeline, the so-called Trans-Caspian one. Now, all of these premises are somewhat starting to fall away. For one, expanding the Southern Gas Corridor project is, of course, more commercially attractive in a higher price environment. Two, in terms of security of demand, the previously uncertain economic rationale of expanding the Southern Gas Corridor, especially as gas in the destination markets was not expected to grow, has now changed due to the potentially changed role of Russian gas. So it's important to mention that the fact remains that Europe will continue to privilege, and that's my third point, its greening policies. And that, despite the political will to reduce dependence on Russian energy, and despite the fact that political will to reduce dependence on Russian energy has sharpened, there might not be much appetite, politically speaking, in Europe to rely yet again on a number of potentially volatile producer and transit countries, not least Turkey. So the geopolitical risk posed by this kind of large undertaking remains. In an environment of already high geopolitical risk, in tight oil and natural gas markets, it remains to be seen to what extent Europe wants to rely on other undemocratic regimes with large or outsized roles in these oil and gas markets. Likewise, the secular shift that I mentioned in my article, the secular shift to renewables that places a strong emphasis on energy efficiency, will continue to condition the appetite for big hydrocarbon investments, both among the world oil majors and political actors, such as the EU. In short, in terms of the Southern Gas Corridor and supplies from gas supplies from Central Asia, there are still limits to how quickly both parties, Europe and Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan, can reorientate their export-import strategy and infrastructure, and both costs and geopolitics will shape the pace and the of change. Yes. But you could argue, I could concede here, that this decision will be driven more by geopolitics than they have been in the recent past. So there might be some more room for the development of these projects. And this could be good from the perspective of the Southern Gas Corridor expansions.
Very good points on this Southern Gas Corridor and overall this rule of Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan. Of course, here we didn't have time to discuss too much Kazakhstan as well. But I would say outside Norway, EU, when it comes to this non-European or authoritarian or any other, let's say, third energy producing countries, it doesn't have too much option when it comes to exporting and importing energy relations. And indeed, as you mentioned, it is always a security concern when it comes to depending on pipeline. But Here, we need to also consider how fast probably the energy transition will move forward in the European market and overall in Europe. And plus, recently they are also discussing to expand this Southern Gas Corridor and include Bulgaria within this further expansion as well. And relying on Turkey, of course, might be concerned as a security, energy security concern. But on the other hand, other scholars also argue that unlike Russia, Turkey is a NATO member. So they have been already securing and protecting each other in another regional security organization. So it's more reliable than Russia when it comes to security, because, as I said, they work for the NATO. And since 1991, they have been working on the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline. So I think similar to Russia here, Turkey and Azerbaijan have also proved their reliability when it comes to energy export and energy supply. But future of this crisis will show us how European energy security will develop and what kind of options, or new options, as you said. Because I really like your highlight that every crisis creates new opportunities, not only negative consequences, but further integration, maybe cooperation. And hopefully this crisis, this negativity, will create a new opportunity to shuffle the foreign policy and make it more, let's say, cooperative and integrative in the future for Europeans and non-European countries as well. Well, I would like to thank Dr. Morena Scalamera for her very fruitful and helpful conversation and the points. Hope that our listeners learned a lot. And please don't forget to subscribe us to your favorite podcast channel. Thank you very much for joining us today. Have a wonderful day. Bye.